This is Astir, talking music with writers and writing with musicians, hosted by me, Carly Brogan, and Joshua James Amberson.
Carly Frisbee Brogan.
Hi, Joshua James Amberson.
Today we have Santi Elijah Holly on the show. It really seems like we're a podcast that prioritizes three names,
right?
Perhaps.
Yeah. That was we didn't even plan that.
Didn't plan that. Yeah.
But going with the three names.
Yeah. I feel like you come to yours a little more honestly or less pretentiously than I do.
How so?
Because you just got married last year.
Right.
And just, you know, added a name to yours.
Right.
And so you had been writing under Carly Frisbee for years. Mm-hmm. And then just tagged on the Brogan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in a transitional period. I'm like weaning off of Frisbee because it's such a mouthful to say Carly Frisbee Brogan. And actually from the E sound to the F sound is Carly, it's really hard. I kind of can't do it. I don't know. You would think I would
Carly Frisbee.
Say my name after all of these years, but Carly Frisbee Brogan.
Yeah.
It just sounds,
Okay. Yeah.
No shame against Frisbee. It's just kind of hard to say.
Right.
And James is your middle name, or is it like another last name?
It is. Yeah, it is my middle name. And I never intended to be a three name writer. But that in the early 2000s, I was publishing a lot of poetry and I was writing.
It's really poetic to have three names.
I wasn't there yet. But I was writing under my first and last name. And then I stopped writing poetry and I was writing prose. And I'd started the zine series that I do, Basic Paper Airplane. And I was playing music and all of that. I wasn't using my last name at all. I was just using Joshua James. Most people just knew me as that kind of.
Okay.
I think a lot of people assumed that James was my last name. And a lot of people assumed that it was kind of, and a lot of people knew that I grew up in the country and kind of, I think, assumed that it was like a two name first name,
Bobby Lou.
Yeah. And that kind of situation. And then I was putting out something, a piece of writing that was going to reach a wider audience. And I was kind of like, what do I do? Because some people know me like this and some people know me like that. And it seems silly now because anything I'd done before that had, you know, comparatively reached such a small audience and that like most of it, you know, isn't even archived on the internet anymore. You know, it was like all print only things that are out of print, you know, just like that it just doesn't matter, but it really mattered to me at the time. And so I was like, I guess I have to use all three. And now I'm like, it doesn't feel like a thing I would do, but it was like, it was like a solution to a problem.
You.
Yeah.
It suits you. I can't, when people say Joshua Amberson, or I just see Joshua Amberson without the James, it seems wrong to me. It feels wrong. Likewise, actually, when people abridge your name to just Josh, that feels like really weird, where I'm
you
like, that's
like
not
it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I am probably the only person that calls you Joshua. I don't know. I feel like a lot of our friends just refer to you as Josh.
Oh, most people shorten it over time. Yeah.
I don't.
I appreciate that you don't, though. I don't care a whole lot, but I like that you don't.
Yeah. I do the same with my husband. I mean, I'm one of the only people that calls him Patrick.
Oh.
But call him Pat, but I call him Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I like full names.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Full names are good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, at the time, there was a musician who was pretty popular who went by Joshua James.
Okay.
In like the 2000, mid 2010s.
Okay.
And I really kind of refused to listen to him.
Yeah, I've never listened to him.
But I interpreted he might be fine. But I interpreted him as kind of a Ryan Adamsy kind of guy, and I was just like, I was like, I don't actually really want to use my last name, and just kind of want to go, but I don't want to be associated with this guy,
right?
And so that was part of the decision too. But Santi, how do you know Santi or know his work?
I met Santi years ago. I guess I'm trying to like remember exactly how. I guess it was just when I was when I had started the MFA program, maybe we had done a reading together. Maybe I had gone to one of his readings. I'm like really trying to think exactly what it was, but I don't recall. I just feel like I've known him for years now, just somehow, but not really sure how.
So, yeah. I think, well, we worked together maybe like 7 years ago at Pals. Him and I, and
that's right, he worked at Pals.
Yeah, and he helped. He was one of the event coordinators there, right. And so I only worked at Pals for half a year, and we kind of crossed paths a little.
Okay,
and then after I quit, I moderated a panel or two there, and you know, so would chat with him when I was doing events, and then we both have written, freelanced for the Portland Mercury, one of the local alt weeklies here, and I've always just felt like we kind of have similar inclinations, where you know he's written, he's more focused on literary journalism, the kind of journalism side of nonfiction, but that he's also done personal essays and short fiction, and that's kind of my
book
mixture.
Reviews and music reviews, and also all of it.
That mixture of arts and culture writing, personal essays, short stories is what I do as well. And so, and I immediately saw, even before he started doing like long form journalism, cover story kind of pieces, when we were both just, you know, reviewing, interviewing musicians or, you know, reviewing books or something, that we just kind of had similar, even if our like exact tastes in music weren't the same, like the spread was kind of a similar spread that, you know, that we kind of like had, we would, you know, just as easily write up like a folk band as we would
a punk band
or hip hop artist or something. Yeah. And just so I really just like respected him right away. I was just oh, this is someone that like I really get.
Yeah.
You know, and on at least like a taste level. And it's been really great to see him, just like what he's done in the last few years. Yeah. I mean, you were reading just like
Vice magazine, The Atlantic,
The
Guardian, The Economist, a whole bunch of stuff. A lot of, whether it's like local weeklies or huge news outlets or literary journals, it just seems like he's tapped into everything, and he's so prolific. I mean, it's not just where he's published, it's just the sheer amount of things he's published too, which I'm sure probably is how much you have published also, you know.
He's really, you know, one thing that I see in his work is he's really smart and, or just really like considerate in how he goes about his pitches for articles. Like he's not, it doesn't seem like he's just like, I'm gonna write for this and I'm gonna do like something for this, and you know, it's not so much that he's just like,
he's not promiscuous with his writing. He's discriminatory, but it's when he knows that it's like the perfect piece for the perfect,
exactly what I was gonna say,
whatever it is,
outlet.
I guess, or publication. It's like, wouldn't be a better fit anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. And this November, he has a book coming out through the 33 and a Third series, long-running series where a writer takes a deep dive into a single album.
Right.
And yeah, really great, really popular, long-running series. And he's doing his on Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Murder Ballads.
Yes, I'm excited.
96 album, I think it was. But
it's, really? Their what album?
1996.
Oh, they're 1996. Yeah, I thought you said their 96th yeah. album. And I'm like, that's what?
yeah. Did you miss
yeah.
a few?
Yeah. yeah. I'm like, what the fuck? Yeah. Yes.
You missed 80 yeah. albums somewhere.
Totally. What? Yeah. Man, I've always wanted to write. I always wanted to write a 33 and a third.
Oh, me too.
For Rid of Me.
Oh.
Which is probably like, I mean, we just talked about this last time, how it's really hard to say what your favorite band is, your favorite album. But if I really, really, really think, go deep, I'm going to have to say it's PJ Harvey, and I'm going to have to say it's that album. But somebody already has.
I was about to say, I think.
And I think I tried even looking at it, and it just wasn't, because it's so, it might be really great, but because it's not like what I have in my head.
Yeah.
I can't read it. So yeah. I'm just going to have to do my own PJ Harvey thing.
Yeah.
Somewhere yeah. else.
Do it. Do I'm it. Going to. I want to read that. But yeah, really excited to talk to him.
Me too.
And yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
10 years ago, I met a girl named Joy. She was a sweet and happy thing. Her eyes were bright blue jewels, and we were married in the spring. I had no idea what happiness a little love could bring, or what life had in store. But all things move toward their end, all things move toward their end, on that you can be sure. Hit it.
So we almost had you on the show, almost had you in studio 5 months ago, and it was early, mid-March, and I think it was a Friday, and Portland basically shut down on a Monday, maybe? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we were going to record in studio, and then, I showed up at like 10 in the morning to get into the studio, and things were just chaos, and I had to call you, and we had to just be like, okay, this, don't come down. This isn't happening. So I'm so glad we got you back on the show.
That was just the beginning of the chaos.
It was the beginning of the chaos. We thought it was a very chaotic day, and having no idea what was to come. Yeah. I'm so glad this is finally working out. Before you were working, you were already kind of at home, working from home, right?
Yeah. But the one issue that came up, I mean, the one thing that was sort of been a setback, even with freelancing, is a lot of stories that I would cover, required me to travel and to speak with people, and obviously that was not an option, or still really isn't an option largely.
Right.
And so a lot of things is just sort of require me to speak with people on the phone that I would normally go speak with in person, and I can't travel because a lot of stories I would cover, I'd travel to other cities or other states, and so it's been a challenge to find stories that I can cover, that I can write about just from home. With the exception of the most recent story that I did that came out yesterday, that was covering the protest downtown. And that was
a great, great article.
Thanks. Yeah, it was interesting, because it was the, When I was assigned this story, when The Economist emailed me and assigned me the story, or asked if I wanted to cover it, they were, I think, expecting that, the protests had been going on, and the sort of nightly clashes with the federal officers had been going on for weeks at that point. And on Thursday, well, so the governor, Oregon Governor Kate Brown, announced the federal withdrawal of these, or the withdrawal of these officers on Wednesday. And so I went to cover the story on Thursday and Friday, and this was the day after the announcement. And so there was no federal presence, no police presence at all, which was strange, you know, sort of unexpected. Right. So that became a sort of a different story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think one that hadn't been, that was the story that I wanted to see. I feel like we already have heard all the other stories, and you talked a lot about, you know, I just think how both sides, like, both sides sort of show the, just showing like the media outlets that sort of like maybe exaggerate both sides to some degree for their own agendas. And it feel, or at least that's how I read it. And it's like, you know, that part about like, we're hearing that our city's under siege. And I've even had myself, like I've had people call me or ask if I'm okay, as if I'm living in like a, you know, crumbling war zone.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm like, it's fine.
Oh, we've all got those calls and emails. Oh, yeah. You know, yeah. Anyone living in Portland is like, you know, and people living elsewhere are just like getting a very kind of narrow perspective on what's going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everybody obviously has a different perspective on what's happening. And there are, you know, there are so many great reporters, local reporters who have been there night after night covering
it. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, I didn't want to sort of detract from any of their coverage because they've been there putting in the work and getting tear gassed and, you know, and just facing, you know, this onslaught nightly. And then I came in sort of just right after everybody left, and I was like, oh, like, where's the party? Like, I was prepared. I mean, I had a helmet, I had goggles, I had a respirator. I was prepared, and then we just stood around for hours and hours, and just, it was so surreal just to see people realizing that it wasn't going to happen. Like, there was going to be no fight tonight, and kind of dejectedly walking away. But then, you know, obviously, you know, the story that I wrote just, you know, I was there to cover that particular night, or those two nights, Thursday and Friday, in front of the Justice Center in the courthouse. But obviously the protests are still happening, not there. Really, they've sort of been spread out. There's different little splinter groups now who are protesting and marching through East Portland, through residential neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And now Portland police is, you know, fighting with them as they were before the federal officers came in. So it's sort of just, they picked up where we left off before the feds came in.
Yeah, what kind of responses have you gotten to it just in the last day?
Yeah, I mean, that's a funny thing about freelancing, or maybe just journalism, or maybe just writing in general, but especially journalism, is like you can, you know, bust your ass on something, writing, reporting, researching, and then you turn it into the editor, and then you have edits that come back to you, and then you have to work on those a little more, and then you go back and forth, and then it's out, and then it's out in the world, and then it kind of just disappears, and you don't really like it. It's rare that I ever get hear feedback unless I'm speaking with somebody directly who read it. You know, I try not to read comments. I've learned the hard way.
Yeah.
Especially like on social media. You know, I'll post something, or I'll see if the magazine posted something on social media, and then, you know, just try to look away from the comments, because I don't know what people are saying about it. I know there were some comments that people were like, you know, hey, the protest isn't over, now Portland police is tear gassing protesters, which is true. But I mean, this could be updated daily, and there'd be,
yeah,
because it's unfolding, you know, in real time. And so it had to sort of end somewhere. And so it ended with, you know, the sort of departure of the federal officers. But obviously, yeah, the fight, the struggle, the protests continue. But you have to end the story somewhere. So that's where that one ended.
For sure. Yeah.
What are you working on right now?
Thanks for asking, Carly. I actually just finished my book proposal for my new nonfiction book, and I sent it to my agent earlier this week, and I think she's going to start shopping it out, sending it out next week. Maybe it's premature, and maybe I shouldn't say this just in case nobody takes it. Like, if nobody, you know, accepts it, then this is going to be really embarrassing. But yeah, no, I mean, but I'm excited, and
that's awesome.
Let's see what happens. So it's a sort of a history, biographical history of sort of early 70s, late 60s, Black liberation movements as told through the Shakur family, the extended Shakur family.
Oh,
so
cool.
We know, you know, we're familiar with obviously Tupac and Assata Shakur, you know, and then there's also Afeni Shakur, who's Tupac's mother, but there's many other Shakurs who were really influential and very militant and their approach to sort of Black liberation, and very, very involved in Black Panthers, but also sort of these groups that came out of the Black Panther Party when the Black Panthers sort of dissolved in the early 70s. There were these smaller and much more radical and much more militant groups that came out of that. And
like the one in, wasn't there one in Philadelphia and they ended up getting bombed?
Yeah, the MOVE organization.
Yeah, the MOVE. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, which was sort of, Mumia Abu-Jamal was sort of affiliated with MOVE. But yeah, MOVE was founded by a man named John Africa, who was also, I believe, a former Panther himself.
Okay.
But there's another group, there's a group called the Black Liberation Army, which is who the Shakurs were also affiliated with. There's a Republic of New Africa, which was a Black secessionist group that actually advocated for land in the southern states and like taking over four southern states to have an independent Black republic in the U.S. And Mutulu Shakur is really was really involved with that, and he was Tupac's stepfather. He was married to Afeni, and also he's currently incarcerated for his involvement in the robbery of a Brinks
Brinks truck.
Yeah, and in which, and during the robbery, a couple of police officers were killed, and some other people were killed, and so he was apprehended years after that. He's also involved with breaking out Assata from prison, where she was doing time for another attempted robbery. Anyways, the family history is just fascinating, and like in sort of this unknown underground Black liberation struggle that was sort of like, you know, kind of just got forgotten in history. Because you know, we think of the Black Panther Party, obviously, but then it's sort of we sort of stop with them. But there were many others who kept on going and were took much more violent action, like shooting police officers, blowing up buildings, robbing banks. And so this book is sort of a history of these movements, but also like a biography of all the Shakurs and how they are connected. And then like leading up to Tupac and how sort of his family history influenced his sort of like early forays into radicalism, which, you know, obviously later he kind of got more commercial, more paranoid, sort of lost a little bit of the sort of radical history that he had, but then he was starting to sort of go back towards when he was killed. So yeah, it's basically just like a, it's like a family genealogy, the Shakurs, and also their sort of, their like how they've shaped the country that we live in now, and like how Black Lives Matter can be sort of like a outgrowth of, you know, these sort of grassroots organizations that don't really have like central leadership, and but have like, you know, momentum and have different factions also in like infighting. Like, there's just like a lot of things to sort of unpack. So that's the latest project.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Oh, it sounds so good. Yeah, what led you to the Shakur family?
Yeah, I've always been curious about them, because, you know, I've listened to Tupac obviously for, you know, since I was a teenager, and then discovered Asada's autobiography, I think later, you know, in college, and then didn't really like put them together, like Asada, Tupac, what's their connection? And then I was like, well, then, you know, and Feeney, his mother is also a former Black Panther. So what's like, where did the name Shakur come? Like, where does it start? And I think I just was just going back, like further and further back, because I wanted to know about this family and how large they were, how influential they were. So I think it just started with me just being really interested in Tupac, and then Asada, and then putting the pieces together and discovering and sort of revealing this large history that I just never even knew about, you know, and I never even knew about like the Black Liberation Army or Republic of New Africa. Like, these are groups that I just feel like are important to know and to learn about, because, you know, it's just so much, I don't know, like inspiration, but also caution, because they obviously, like, they a lot of them were either shot by police or they were locked up, or Asada is still in exile in Cuba. So there's a lot of caution in like going too far. Like, you know, how far is too far when you're fighting for, you know, like equality and rights. So, like, you can definitely get carried away and go too far, which, right. So it's sort of a cautionary story also.
Yeah. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. I'm so excited. I feel like you won't regret talking about it, because I'm pretty sure someone's going to pick up on this book. But you sent us, for your playlist, you sent us Tupac's Trapped. They got me trapped. Uh-huh, they can't keep the Black man down. They got me trapped. Nah, they can't keep the Black man down. Trapped. They got me trapped, can barely walk the city streets without a cop harassing me, searching me, then asking my identity. Hands up, throw me up against the wall, didn't do a thing at all. Telling you one day these suckers gotta fall. Cuffed up, throw me on the concrete, coppers tried to kill me, but they didn't know this was the wrong street. Bang, bang, count another casualty, but it's a cop who shot his brutality. Who do you blame? It's a shame, because the man's slain. He got caught in the chains of his own gang. How can I feel guilty after all the things they did to me? Sweated me, hunted me, trapped in my own community. One day I'm gonna bust, blow up on this society. Why did you lie to me? I couldn't find a trace of equality. Worked me like a slave while they laid back. Homie, don't play that. It's time to let them suffer the payback. I'm trying to avoid physical contact. I can't hold back. It's time to attack, Jack. They got me trapped. You know they got me trapped. Nah, they can't keep the Black man down. Trapped. They can't keep the Black man down. What did you choose that one over, from this catalog?
Yeah, that's that is really actually kind of a fascinating story behind the song and just the events that happened around that. I mean, that's on, so Trapped is from his debut album, Tupacalypse Now, and which most of the songs in that are, he's still like in the mindset of sort of struggle for Black rights and sort of Black power. He's still in sort of like Black power mentality, and also fighting against police brutality. So there's there's a verse where he talks about shooting a police officer who was harassing him, and then that's why he's locked up. He's now doing time for shooting a police officer who was brutalizing him and harassing him. And it's, so the interesting thing about that, there's two things, and there's many things, but Tupac's stepfather, Mutulu, as I said, years, in the early 80s, was charged with the same thing, was shooting a police officer, and incarcerated for the same thing. And so, and Mutulu is still, he's still alive, he's still incarcerated, but, and he was incarcerated for most of Tupac's childhood, but they still had a connection. They still met with each other. Like, he would go visit him, and they would, and he was sort of a mentor to a young Tupac. So it's sort of like he's kind of, in a way, paying homage to, his stepfather Mutulu with this song, with that verse. And then the other side of that is, after the album came out, there was somebody in Texas who was, I think it was in 1992, and he was a drug dealer. He was driving a stolen car. He was pulled over by Texas Highway Patrol. So the album's been out for a year. This guy who's driving the stolen car gets pulled over by the highway patrol, shoots him, kills him. He kills a police officer, gets caught, and they find a copy of Tupacalypse Now in his tape deck, which he was listening to at the time. And so they brought that into the trial, and then he ended up saying, they ended up using that album, Trapped, in particular, and also another song called Soldier Story, which also sort of talks about shooting a police officer. They sort of brought that up as evidence, or at least as sort of to say that Tupac was a he's encouraging this, he's influencing, cop killing. Wow. And Vice President Dan Quayle came out against Tupac and said, we need to, ban these, record label needs to pull this record from the shelves. And so I just felt like it was so fascinating that he is sort of like, in his way, Tupac was sort of like carrying on this, rather, it's pretty shameful history. I mean, like, to advocate for something, but also to say, this is where I come from. Like, this is what's going on, and like, this is, just reality. This is what I'm dealing with. This is what we're dealing with. But sort of how, like, life imitating art, imitating life again. So that song sort of just speaks to not just Tupac's storytelling ability, but also how influential, or how much of a threat people still view, this sort of, these words coming from, a Black man, saying that, he caused this just by virtue of this song. And so it's sort of life repeating itself So that's why, that song is just sort of like, I didn't even think about that when I was, first started working on the book proposal, and then I came to that song, and I was like, "Oh, this is exactly what his forebears were doing basically in real life was shooting at police officers, and I didn't realize that I didn't connect that he was basically just like telling their stories with that song.
I understand you have a project coming out pretty soon, and do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it'll be out November 12th, so pretty soon.
Yeah,
and it's pretty different from this new project. It is sort of a true crime history of the murder ballad tradition by using Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds murder ballads album as sort of a jumping off point. I go through each of the 10 songs on that record. Cool. And sort of trace them back to their origins, which in some cases go back centuries to, like 16th century Britain or Ireland, and how these ballads, many of them started with a true story. Many of them were just fictionalized, but they would grow and they would evolve over the years. People would interpret them differently. And then people would bring them to the United States. You know, when people would immigrate here, they'd have these ballads that they, you know, from home. And then they sort of morphed, became like joined existing ballads or became new ballads altogether. But it's sort of, just sort of showing how ballad making and songwriting evolves and takes from real life events and from literature, from newspaper articles. People just, you know, like ballad making started as just a form of telling events that happened and sort of sharing stories, either as cautionary tales or just to sort of, or as sensationalism, you know, sort of just like making light of something that happened. But it's sort of where, I mean, there's so many contemporary songs and songwriters who pull from these old songs, these old ballads. And so Nick Cave's record, Murder Ballads, is basically just like reinterpreting all these songs and sort of making them his own. He adds his own, you know, flavor to them. He has his own little Nick Cave-ishness to them. makes them really violent. But murder ballads themselves, I mean, the murder ballad tradition goes back years and years as a way of sharing news, you know, sort of the social media of its day, with sort of just distilling something down and sharing it widely. It's fun I just went through song by song and learned the history, learned people who other people throughout the years who have done their own interpretations of these songs, added some just stuff about why Nick Cave might have been drawn to these ballads, and how he changed them and sort of a little bit of the recording of the songs, like what was going on during the recording sessions. Just a little bit of history, a little bit of music history.
Yeah. How did you think of this idea?
The book, so Bloomsbury Academic has been doing has this book series called 33 a Third, which has been long running. I mean, I don't know. I think my book is like the 151st or something like that. Yeah. So they put out a lot of these books and they're just kind of short, pocket sized books. In each book addresses, focuses on, one record, you know, one musician's record, and just dives in really deep into that one record. And, you know, and people can think, people kind of have written about in many different ways about these records. Like, there's some that write personal memoirs of like how this record affects them. There's some people that just go into the recording details and, you know, they tell about who was in the studio, who was the engineer, who was pushing the buttons. And, you know, I didn't really want to go that direction because sometimes it's just a little boring and nerdy. I mean, some people really like that, but like, you know,
A lot of times I've seen I want to buy a 33 and a third book, and I'll pick up one for like a band I really like or an album I really like, and then I start thumbing through, and it is more of like a technical thing where I'm like, ugh.
I was just about to say the same thing, where even though I love that stuff and like have done music recording stuff, I'm just like, I can't go this deep, you know, or like it just like it's a level or like a line I don't want to cross. But there are some 33 and a thirds that I find really interesting, especially when they're kind of looking broader or doing something interesting with the format or telling a personal story. I do think there's some really great ones out there, but I don't know that I've read one that kind of went as broad as this one. And so when you told me about it a while back, I was really excited about it because this is the kind of 33 and a third I've always wished for and hoped for. It was one that kind of deviated from the artist, that used the artist and the album as a jumping point into a lot of other history. And but I am curious, when you mentioned it to me, you know, months ago, or most of a year ago now, that you were like, I'm not sure what Nick Cave fans are going to think of it. And
I mean,
do you worry about that at all? Or do you like, are like,
I'm not worried about it. I feel like I state in the, you know, synopsis, what kind of book it is. I'm trying to be pretty clear about that. It's not like a biography of Nick Cave. I think a lot of people are just going to, you know, want more Nick Cave content than I have. I mean, there is plenty of Nick Cave, like gossip and, quotes and, but I didn't get to speak with him directly, but I did get to, interview a couple band members, who were really, generous with their time, which was really cool. And I got a little bit of recording details, not just to pacify, you know, Nick Cave, but like, I mean, just enough that makes it sort of puts it into perspective, like when certain songs were recorded. I mean, for instance, like Stagger Lee, which was, you know, the probably the most popular song on that record, almost wasn't included. They'd wrapped recording sessions, and then they were ready just to call it a record without Stagger Lee. But then, sort of at the 11th hour, Jim Sklavounos, who was the percussionist, brought this book that was sort of a compilation and anthology of like old Black toasts, which are just sort of like toasting is sort of just talking shit, basically. It's just like, and there was one in there for Stagger Lee, and it was just really, you know, and he showed it to Nick and was like, hey, you know, this is some really cool stuff in here. Just take a look at it. And so Nick Kay was flipping through it and found Stagger Lee and was like, let's do this, you know, let's record this song, and just did it right then and there, and then added it. So yeah, stuff like that, which is sort of like, that's, you know, that's a cool little like factoid to include. So that kind of stuff is in there in the book also.
Yeah, and you sent us the part of the chapter, which I'd love to hear in a minute from a little bit of that. But in that chapter, you say that that, you know, and it's been a little while since I read it when. 5 months ago when you were going to be on the show, but that you said that that the band had been listening to, I think it was the Geto Boys on tour.
Yeah.
And that, so the beat of it, the drum and bass part, was inspired by all of that listening to the Ghetto Boys, and I was like,
yeah,
oh, you know. And then I went back and I immediately listened to it and kind of, and I like pulled up a Ghetto Boys song and was just kind of like, was like, oh, I can totally see it. I can totally see that they were just, you know, inspired or you know, kind of biting from that. So
yeah, I mean, it's funny because their version of Stagger Lee really, I mean, musically and lyrically really is unique. I mean, it does pull from a lot of, I mean, it's basically a cover song. I mean, he
right
just sort of spliced together a couple of different Stagger Lee versions, and but yeah, musically it's basically just like, you know, that groove is just like I mean, it's closer to hip hop than obviously right. to folk or rock.
Yeah, it was so interesting listening to the medley that you sent us, you know, and listening to like Mississippi John Hurt's like really like gentle voice and mm-hmm. delicate finger picking. It almost sounds like something, you know, like a lullaby, you know, compared yeah. to like Nick Cave, who's all like snarling and devious, and it's very like ghost story, evil, just a totally the same story pretty much, but just that context, like telling it, not just, not even necessarily like there are variances in the story per se. I mean, I know there are like minor variances, but just that context of the music surrounding it makes mm-hmm. the story seem so different, you know?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. That, I mean, it really is like, it's the music changes how you hear the song. I mean, yeah, Mississippi John Hurt's is almost like, he doesn't really seem like that bad of a guy.
Maybe, but like, right, exactly. It's so soft.
Yeah. But then obviously you have like just a rock band, you know, doing it in their own version, it's just going to sound much more like sinister and violent.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah, I want us to listen to a few of these versions, just at least to kind of get. There's so many versions yeah. of Stagger Lee, but the versions you sent us kind of like give a really nice line from the 1920s and early recorded folk blues to the 90s and the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds version, which there was a hole in my versions of Stagger Lee that you really filled in here. And, but I would love to hear a little bit from the Stagger Lee chapter of your 33 and a third book, if you want to read a few paragraphs.
Yeah. Happy to. So this is just the first few paragraphs of this chapter. Stagger Lee. He was a bad man. Some say he was a gambler and a pimp. Some say he was a trickster, a shapeshifter. Others say he sold his soul to the devil in exchange for a magical John B. Stetson hat, which granted him supernatural powers. And some folks say the devil was so scared of him, he let him take over hell, where he has ruled to this day. Whoever he was, one thing was certain. Stagger Lee was not a man to be trifled with. The legend of Stagger Lee, or Stack-a-Lee, Stag-o-Lee, Stag-Lee, or Stack-o-Lee, began near the start of the 20th century, when variations of his name first started making the rounds of the gambling dens, saloons, levy work crews, prisons, and chain gangs. Musicians composed songs in his honor. Singers sang his praises. Outlaws and criminals canonized him as a patron saint. But though no one knew his real name, or if he had ever existed, they knew his deeds, or most of them. What they didn't know, they made up, adding to his exploits, and so his legend grew exponentially. His name floated along the Mississippi River from the Midwest down to New Orleans, where the stevedores, longshoremen, and hustlers all adopted him as their own. Though the details have been revised, distorted, and exaggerated over the course of a century with innumerable performances and recordings, the basics are this. A man called Stagger Lee walks into a bar, gets into an argument with another man named Billy Lyons, or Billy DeLion, Billy the Lion, or Billy Dilly, either over a Stetson hat or a card game. Stagger Lee shoots Billy dead, then calmly turns and exits the bar. In some versions, Stagger Lee is arrested and hanged for his deed. While in other tellings, Stagger Lee's fate is inconclusive, allowing him to live in eternal infamy. Nick Cave, explaining his decision to record the song, said, quote, "I like the way the simple, almost naive traditional murder ballad has gradually become a vehicle that can happily accommodate the most twisted acts of deranged machismo."
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Thanks so much for reading.
Yeah. So then I go on to sort of talk about, you know, the real Staggerly, and his real life and his real crimes and sort of the first appearances of ballads that talked about Staggerly. Yeah, and I think, I mean, and with something like this, I mean, it is, I mean, it's just crazy that it's basically just a simple crime, just a murder. I mean, I think there was, you know, there are many other murders that happened in St. Louis that night. It was Christmas night in 1895, but you know, it wasn't like this. There's nothing that was really like stood out about this person shooting another person in a bar fight, except it was so cold blooded. It was so the way that Staggerly kind of responded and shot Billy DeLion, and
it was like mechanical and unemotional almost.
Yeah, yeah. And just took his hat back and walked out of the bar. And I think, for whatever reason, the word spread, and it just, you know, as things happen, you know, when you tell a story to friends, you exaggerate. And so it's sort of like the ballad became just an exaggeration of what he did and his deeds. Mm-hmm. And so it just, you know, caught fire, and people just associated him with this sort of anti-hero. You know, like this figure that was just so cold-blooded, you know. And so, we celebrate villains who are just so villainous that they have to be at least respected for how,
right. Yeah.
How cold-blooded they are. So yeah, sort of like that with him.
I think these characters become like vessels for what we want to reflect in ourselves at any given time, because like there's like a subtext to storytelling, like that these stories aren't true, or they're like wildly exaggerated, or you know, they aren't true in like a fact checkery way, but then they're also kind of like more true because through the pass down, through like telephone, through the like different hands that it's been passed through, and through the sort of patina that builds on it, it actually reflects something that's more true than the story itself. It's almost like the story itself becomes like a moot point, and
right,
you know, and so it's like showing the way it's told is reflective of the people that are telling it.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, it's whether or not it's factually accurate, it still tells a truth, a bigger truth about society, about humanity, as any sort of myth does. I mean, a myth can be based in truth or not, but mm-hmm. but it tells a story about us, you know, about our interactions with each other, how, you know, our history, our shared, you know, common humanity. Like it's just, that's what all ballads really do, is just, mm-hmm. Tell stories about people and events, but really speaking to the larger picture of society during that time. And that's why, you know, ballads change over the years, because they have to reflect the times that they're in.
They don't
stay frozen. Like you're not singing the same ballad, you know, 1901 that you'll be singing today. Like you would obviously want to like update it to to reflect the times.
And I can't remember, the kind of set that you sent us starts with Mississippi John Heard in 1928. Is that the first recording that we know of it?
No. The first recording, I'm gonna have to double check that. The first mention of somebody playing a song called Staggerly was in a newspaper in 1891, a piano player was going to play a song about Stagger Lee. But the first recording, let's see, the first recordings were 1923. There's two different bands, Fred Waring's Pennsylvanians and Frank Westfall and his orchestra. Those were recorded the same year in 1923. Those are two white bands, like white sort of jazz bands.
Right.
But I think those were instrumental. So it was called the Stagger Lee Blues, but they were sort of just dance songs without lyrics. And it sort of just added the name Stagger Lee just to make it sound like, you know, kind of badass.
Right.
And then after that, might have been Ma Rainey, I think, recorded it. She did it next one in 1926. And hers, she does sing on. That might have been the first one with words.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, Carly, you talked a little about the Mississippi John version. Let's listen to a second of it just to kind of get the feel of it.
The feel. It's so sweet.
Officer, how can it be? You can rest everybody but cruel Stagger Lee, that bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee. There's a line told Stagger Lee, please don't take my life. I got two little babies and a darling loving wife, that bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee.
So yeah, what's some context for that song?
He recorded that in 1928. His version is, I think, one of the more influential because it has that refrain at the end, that bad man, you know, sort of just reminding you, he's a bad man, his name is Stagger Lee.
Yeah.
I think a lot of musicians after that kind of copied that template of the two lines, the couplet in the front and then the refrain. I think, and his is just, yeah, you know, like you said, it is, it's so sweet. I mean, Mississippi John Hurt's guitar playing, his singing style is so, it invites you in. You're just like, just feel so, he's telling you a story. Like, it is like a lullaby. Like, he's really just, he's not singing a song, he's telling a story.
Right.
It's also funny because his version plays very loose with the facts of what happened. But obviously, you know, like we were saying, that doesn't really matter with the facts of, you know, like what happened was. I mean, people change how he was shot, why he was shot, the name of the bar, how many kids Billy had, what Stagger Lee said when he shot him. Like, just like, you know, adding just different little, adding little, you know, just... adding little things that really didn't happen, but it doesn't really matter because it sounds good and it rhymes.
Yeah. It's kind of a way of personalizing too, right?
Yeah.
It's like, now that's his version, you know, because he did all these different, you changed all the details in his own way, you know.
And for musicians, and for older like folk and blues musicians back then, who, you know, a lot of them couldn't read or write, and you know, and so they would listen to a song, they'd hear it played by somebody, you know, like neighbor or whoever, and then they'd go home and teach it to themselves, you know, learn it themselves. And you know, they didn't have the benefit of looking up the lyrics on the internet, right. Or
yeah,
so they would just, what they couldn't remember, they would just make up their own.
Yeah, yeah. And when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I kind of had a, just really went into the 20s and 30s blues and folk blues, and you know, loved it all and was so interested in kind of, you know, seeing, yeah, that it was just the beginning of so much of the rest of the 20th century music to come, mm-hmm. you know. And but of all of them, I really just fell in love with Mississippi John Herrick, because like you said, like, he's just so inviting, and you know, it's all just so good. And that was 1928 sessions are recorded so well, you know, compared mm-hmm. to a lot of the music that was being recorded in that era. So, you know, I think that's the first version of Staggerly I heard. But pretty soon after, I heard this next one you sent, the Lloyd Price one.
That's the first one I heard.
Yeah, which is from 1959 and mm-hmm. was kind of a pop hit, I think. And yeah, so let's listen to a minute of that.
The night was clear. And the moon was yellow, and the leaves came tumbling down. I was standing on the corner when I heard my bulldog bark. He was barking at the two men who were gambling in the dark. It was
So whole different vibe there.
Yeah. No, I love that version. That's so, I mean, yeah, totally different song. But it's, I mean, it's good. I mean, it was a hit. I mean, it was a number one Billboard hit.
Wow.
And yeah, obviously, like, you know, his, in this telling, it's an argument over a craps game that leads right. to, you know, which is, you know, not the case at all. Yeah, but it's just such, like, I mean, and like, I saw a video of Lloyd Price doing this song, and there's like a bunch of white people like dance, like doing like the twist or whatever dance was popular, and just like, wow, you're doing twist to this song. I mean, it's such a weird sight, and just to think about that, it's basically about, you know, a black man killing another black man over a craps game, and it's just like pop hit where like these suburban white teenage kids are twisting away to it.
So weird.
I first knew about this song actually because of the movie Shag. I don't know if y'all have seen that movie. Mm-hmm. It was like, I think it's from 1989, and it was maybe riding off the coattails of the success of like Dirty Dancing or something, but it was it's based on this dance, the Carolina Shag, and like you were just saying, it's a bunch of white people that are doing this dance contest, you know, on their summer vacation or their spring break or whatever, and yeah, this is the song that, like, for the sort of the penultimate scene of the movie, the like dance contest in which, you know, the heroes win. And it is funny to think that, yeah, this song about murder and it's being played by a live band, which is a black band, but then it's these white kids that just jubilantly swing each other to this song about murder.
Yeah, that's funny. I haven't seen that, but I should look at that.
I've actually, side note, been wanting to almost rewatch it just in terms of like the race relations, because it actually is very, very loaded with it. It's a great movie and I loved it, but it is very loaded. Like there's a lot of like The Help and a lot of The Entertainment, and The Help and The Entertainment are all black and everybody else is white, and it's plantation money. There's a Confederate flag in the movie. It shows up on a bikini. There's a lot of Whistlin' Dixie and a lot of Big Tobacco. It's interesting, like the symbols in that watching it as a kid in middle school, I didn't catch, and I just thought this is the most fun movie and I love it, but I really want to rewatch it and look at all of that, you know.
Yeah, and actually that also brings up a point that I sort of address in this chapter about the relationship of white artists doing this song or even like or just covering it and sort of their relation to this figure of Stagger Lee, and sort of like Stagger Lee was this hero, I mean, you know, sort of bad hero in the black community before he was ever, embraced by popular white performing artists. He became so popular, I think, you know, in the early ballads, and why he was so popular on like Longshoremen and Stevedores and Levee Camp work crews. And, it's because his legend, was like this bad, you know, like, this bad black dude that doesn't take shit from anybody, you know, who just like this sort of hero, an anti-hero. And so that's why it's also just a strange thing of like, you know, he was so integral and such an, you know, and sort of weird inspiration to take from. But, you know, he represented this this bad, like boastful, violent, dude who, you know, that was sort of his origin, and that's why he was, but then, you know, it gets sort of whitewashed, so to speak, over time.
Right.
Well, the next one in this kind of, you know, journey toward the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds version is the one I missed, the one that I had never heard. It came out in 1969, and I knew a different version of Stagger Lee from 1969, which was the Taj Mahal version.
Oh yeah.
Which is off the double album, The Giant Step, Old Folks at Home one, and which is really good, but doesn't kind of fill in the blanks that I needed to get to the Nick Cave versions, because I was kind of looking at the Nick Cave version as like wholly created by him or something. But this is really... So this is, they're Snatching the Poontangs. Is that the band?
Snatching the Poontangs. Yeah. Which was a novelty band. And they weren't really even, I mean, they were a band, but they just put out this novelty record just for fun. But, it was Johnny Otis, who actually was a popular, guitar player and singer and composer, and his son, Shuggie Otis, who became, you know, a really great artist later. But yeah, Shuggie was like 16 years old. I mean, it's just like really explicit, really like the cover of the records, the cover of the album itself has like a for adults only sign and like this like R. Crumb illustration.
Right.
And it's
right.
All, and the whole thing is just, yeah, it's just like lewd, novelty, like really sexually explicit songs. Yeah, but it's a good find. It's a good dive into that. I asked the bartender for something to eat.
she gave my mother a glass of water, a stale piece of meat. I said, Mr. Bartender, don't you know who I am? I said, frankly, no, I don't give a damn. I said, it's me, the great Stagger Lee. I heard of you from down the way. But I whoop motherfuckers just like you each and every day. A flash of lightning, the bartender was dead. He had six holes in his motherfucking head by me, yeah.
I love that version.
Yeah, had you heard that before, Carla?
No, I hadn't heard it, but fun fact, Johnny Otis, like they lived up the hill from me. So you could hear in the evening, this is in Sebastopol, California, and they would have like parties and stuff. And like every now and then, for a long time, I didn't know who it was. And then somebody was like, oh, that's Johnny Otis. He lives up the hill. And he was like a local hero. They were always playing in town, and there would be all the time like flyers of like Johnny and Shuggy and the whole gang are playing tonight at this bar or whatever. So you could hear him playing and stuff like that, which is kind of exciting. But I do love this sort of, like this boogie woogie driving blues kind of.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's awesome. You get to like listen to them jam. It's a funny version. So there's a lot of lines obviously in that Nick Cave took from, and there's another track on that same album that called Two Time Slim, which has some lines that Nick Cave also borrowed. So it's basically, some of the worst, most like explicit, just shocking lines that Nick Cave sings on Stagger Lee are from Snatch and the Poontangs.
That filled in a lot for me when I heard Stagger Lee when I was Nick Cave Stagger Lee. You know, when I was, in my late teens, early 20s, I was like, whoa, this is amazing. But, you know, I don't know. It was just like, I don't know how I feel about this, but it's really good. And then, you know, and then getting to see how, you know, that he was borrowing from this album was really like, it was illuminating. I was like, oh, this is like him, like not just like taking something and doing his own thing with it, but actually like referencing the tradition of the song.
Yeah.
And this record itself, from the Snatch and the Poontangs record, those lyrics also reference that book, the Book of Toasts that James Clavinos had. So it's sort of, it's started with the book, but also the book is just an anthology of things that were already out, and out, people that were already saying these things. So some of these lines that made it into both Nick Cave and Snatch and the Poontangs songs had probably been floating around just in the community, like in prisons, in the black community, like on the streets, for, years before that. It's just sort of, so it's not really, to think of it like, oh, who did it first or who stole this from whom, like sort of isn't the point. It's more just like, that is sort of the nature of songwriting, is you borrow things and you put things together and you sort of put your own melody behind it. Sometimes there's straight plagiarism, but with something like this, like that there is no real, there's no author, and that's true with all these ballads. There's no real author. Nobody just sat down and with a notebook and wrote these words and copyrighted it, and then it's just sort of like, it's just everything.
Almost like free domain.
Yeah,
and it's very different mindset than like us looking at it now, you know, that there's this, it's a concept that is like both easy to grasp and hard to grasp. And then, you know, just growing up in a culture that was like, you know, that everything's copyrighted and everything's, you know, like that there's these huge lawsuits that in all of our, you know, since we were kids have been playing out in courts over samples and over covers and over the melodies of songs being too similar to other songs. And sometimes those are, you know, that those things like, you know, have validity behind them, but also that they like are just like that we grew up in a whole different relationship to songwriting or this, you know, like, or like music as kind of an evolving force than the folk, than this idea of the folk song and the folk tradition and folk ballads and just things evolving over time through different interpretations and players, and that there's like an oral tradition kind of growth that happens within it that is just so different than how we view creative work today.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the funny thing is, with writing this book, you know, there's with copyright law, you are not legally allowed to reproduce lyrics without paying the copyright holder, in some cases, a lot of money. So there's a reason why there's not a lot of quotes like from Nick Cave songs, but there is public domain. So if it's, I don't remember what year it is, but like that it stops, then it's, that is sort of fair use or something that you can use. You can, the copyright holders don't, doesn't apply before like 1940 something. Like you can freely quote song lyrics, but I can't freely quote that many Nick Cave lyrics because there is still the copyright on those, which is ironic, which is rich, you know, to be like, you know, he didn't even write these words. Like most of the lyrics, you know, he just took from other people. So now to say like, oh, but now I'm the copyright holder, you know, it's, I don't know. It's funny, but it was sort of a pain in the ass when I was like trying to figure out how to write this without, you know, without, infringing upon copyright.
You would think that if you were writing a book about an album that then you would be able to, yeah, I don't know. I guess I just never thought about that. That's quite the,
yeah, it was kind of a pain, yes.
It impedes your work, you know?
Yeah. I've had friends run into it in novels and memoirs too, you know, where they quoted from a song and then had to take it out because it was just too expensive to even have a few lines in there. And yeah, I think it varies from, you know, like, depending on what label and something came out on or what,
whether
you know,
contract.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure about that part, but it does seem like some lyrics are more expensive to obtain than others, but let's listen to the Nick Cave version.
His woman threw him out on the ice and the snow, and she told him never ever come back no more. Staggerly. So he walked through the rain and he walked through the mud till he came to a place called the Bucket of Blood. Staggerly. He said, Mr. Motherfucker, you know who I am. And the barkeeper said, no, and I don't give a good goddamn to Stagger Lee. He said, well, bartender, it's a plain to see. I'm the bad motherfucker called Stagger Lee. Mr. Stagger Lee. Well, the barkeeper said, yeah, I heard your name down the way. And I kept motherfucking asses like you every day. Mr. Stagger Lee. Well, I froze for the last words that the barkeep said, 'cause they put four holes in his motherfucking head.
But this is the accumulation of, you know, whatever, 70, almost 70 years of versions by the time we get to the Nick Cave version, not to even count the kind of oral tradition and unrecorded versions that we're not hearing. But this one really stands out on the album. And one thing Carly brought up before we started the show is just that, you know, just like this album in the Nick Cave discography. And and we were a little curious if this was your favorite album, or if you kind of saw this as an entry point into this bigger stories, all the, you know, the whole history of murder ballads and the folk tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually wasn't a Nick Cave fan when I first discovered this record, which was in my early 20s, I mean, or maybe even late teens. Like I found it, I was intrigued by the title because, you know, like you, I was also really listening to a lot of folk and blues music back then. Like, I really just loved early blues, early folk music, early ballads. And I think I was familiar with Nick Cave because I also listened to a lot of punk rock and just stuff like that. And So I was just curious, like, what this, you know, what it was, like, what this record was. I was just, like, fascinated with somebody like Nick Cave's doing these songs that I was already familiar with, you know. And so I bought the record, and I think I fell in love with it immediately. I was blown away just by what he was doing with these ballads, just, you know, making them, like, unique, fun, just, I mean, also just when you're, you know, that age and you're just like, oh, this is so great, this is so violent and shocking and everything.
Yeah.
I still didn't really get into Nick Cave that much. I listened to that one album a lot. And other ones didn't really do it for me the same way. Late years later, I did start to really become more of a fan, especially the record before Murder Ballads, Let Love In, and the one before that, Henry's Dream, are great. And so, yeah, I became, you know, I sort of found my way to Nick Cave through this record. I don't know if I'd say it's my favorite one at this point. I mean, obviously I've sentimental attachment to it, and I
spent the most time with it.
I spent a lot of time with it, so in a way it's my favorite, but I don't think it's his best record. And I don't think, you know, he didn't even think, and he and the band in interviews would talk about the record and say that they didn't think it was going to be successful. They thought it was going to flop. They recorded it sort of just for fun. But they didn't, you know, they didn't really think that it was going to be a hit. They thought that people were going to, like, you know, like, chase them out of town. And so they were surprised, you know, also that it kind of became one of their most beloved records, especially because Stagger Lee, I mean, that's, I think, you know, they do that song just about every show as their encore. They don't do any other songs live. As far as I've never heard or seen them doing, but a lot of those songs really can't be done live. Stagger Lee obviously can, but a lot of them are just so, they're made for listening to at home, you know, like they're not really like a songs to perform for an audience.
They're studio songs.
Yeah.
And yeah, this will be out pretty quickly.
The Murder Ballads book will be out November 12th, and I'm hoping that I can do a in-person book reading, but if not, then just do it online like everything else.
Fingers crossed.
Well, if it has to be a virtual book release party, we'll be there.
I'll go.
Great. All right. Sounds good.
Homes in Portland, Oregon. It can be heard through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, as well as our website. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. New episodes come out every 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us.